My name is Kent Badoon, and we've been working the last few days through developmental life cycles. And we call them dynamic life cycles because they dynamically intermesh with one another. That is, that as you complete one stage of development or go through one series of changes in your life, that those either help or inhibit your ability to go through another set of changes. That those sets of stages in development occur more at the beginning of your life, from, say, 0 to 12, than they do in later years, but at the same time, those changes need to keep on happening all along. That is to say, full human development occurs throughout your whole life, that it doesn't just stop at one place. There are various points at which you need to stand back and reevaluate, kind of get your bearings, and maybe even reappraise the situation and look at it in a way that you never thought you would look at. And we're going to talk today about some things that happen to families and also teenagers and families. I'm hoping that we can also get into later stages of family development, that is, what happens when children leave families, and what happens when a family grows older, and how does it keep together if it does keep together. Those are just some of the things I'd like to touch on today. I've had some sheets available which depict the life stages, and I've got a few of those here. Let me just pass this around if you haven't seen it. That depicts pretty much what we've been going through, and we've been using that as a catalyst. Perhaps you could share with June that, and as you can see also. What we've been talking about is a consecutive life stages that evolve and help a person to know what kinds of things they are probably facing in a given stage. All that we're talking about here is what happens to people as they grow in a normal family, quote, normal family. Now, there are not many of those around, if you haven't noticed. It is a family that's not affected by divorce, or a single parent family, or a family that is free of excessive stress. Our culture in itself could be called an excessive stress in some ways, I guess, but yet these are the normal stresses that you can expect, not even taking into conceptualization of these changes, things like deaths of parents or grandparents, or death of a sibling, or any other of the myriad stresses that can occur to a family. So, let's take a minute to look at what kinds of things are major issues, or at least some of the theorists say are major issues, in a family that has teenagers. There's a list there. Would you like to read a couple of those points in stage?
Stage four?
Yeah, stage four. That's what we're up to, I guess.
The Solomon.
Mike Solomon says some tasks are.
And this is for families, teenage years, I guess. Tasks are relinquishing primary gratification in the roles of parent-child. Seek need satisfaction from peer group. That has to do with an exiting family member. Attain new marital balance without primary gratification from children. Find outside hobbies, new interests, social networks. That's for the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Those are four tasks, and concerns are holding on to the last child to maintain family balance. The Rhodes list of tasks.
First, let's just look at those. Do any of those strike you as situations that may have come up in your experience, or that you'd like to think about some more out loud?
Actually, the Rhodes list, it already talks about actual departure of children as though they're leaving the home.
Uh-huh.
That's the way I would.
Well, what happens when a child graduates from high school? What kind of changes occur in a home, if any?
Well, depends. If the child goes to college or leaves home, they leave home, and if they don't, they're still there. As we talked the other day, we have one who didn't leave home when he graduated from high school, and is still there, and one who did.
Uh-huh.
And
how do you deal with that?
Well, we talked about blocking out how long that would go on, and doing it, and sort of blocked it out that it's a year at a time, and reevaluating what's happening at the end of each year. And I really, that year isn't over yet, so I really don't know what will happen 4 or 5 months from now.
It's his son, right?
Yeah, right. That's the rock musician.
Right. Does he pay rent? Or?
No, not yet. No.
Okay.
But that's one of the.
I've heard of parents doing that.
That's one of the things that's on the table as if this continues, it will come to that. But I don't know if that would be yet this fall. It all depends on the progress and whether it looks like he's heading toward independence yet. The idea is that he become independent as soon as possible.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, I went to college for a year, and then I got out and started earning money, so I got money hungry. And at that point then, I was still at home, but I paid rent, and I had some responsibilities in the home, but I still felt somewhat independent of the home.
I think he wants to become independent for other reasons too, because the arrangement we have is that as long as he is at home, he participates as a part of the family, and it's not an apartment or just a place to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So he, you know, has chores to do regularly and things like that. I mean, as long as he is not going to enjoy the benefits of being a part of the household, he has to be a part of the household. It's not just a place to be or stay. So.
Hmm.
And he buys into that all right so far.
Well, how would you respond to a parent who would simply say, well, when I was 18, I was kicked out of my house and had to make it on my own, so I think you should too. Son?
Maybe if I'd been kicked out when I was 18, I would have said that. I don't know. That wasn't the way my parents dealt with me.
Okay.
I did what the normal, you know, I went off to college and really did become quite independent. And there were no traumatic experiences, so, you know. No big arguments or things, whereas this has not been easy. The oldest son went to college 3 years, and he is now not in college, but is still being supported by us. But the idea is that he's trying farming for a year, and if that's where he decides to go, then he becomes independent, and we're no longer his means of support.
What I hear is correct, you're kind of giving both of your sons buffer periods,
yeah,
to evaluate their own decisions and kind of saying, well, we're going to set this deadline out there for a year from now to kind of reevaluate and make some definite decisions about it.
Yep.
What does that do for them and for you?
Well,
I mean, what are the advantages of that as opposed to saying, this is it, bang?
Well, the advantages for them is it allows them a little bit more time to make sure that they are going down a path that they want to go down. I don't know if there are any advantages for us. I don't know of any.
Yeah. So it's harder on you to extend or not?
Oh, I think so.
How did you all deal with your kids leaving?
With the kids leaving, well, we had, I mentioned that two of ours took a breather, well, one after high school, and spent some time up at Holden, in fact. Well, she graduated after her senior year, in January, she was through. So then she came out here for a while, and needed that breather, I think, in between high school and college. And then after she graduated from college, had worked for a year. Her major is geology, And because that sense of independence is there, you know, she wanted to be on her own. And then went back, and she's finishing up her doctorate. So, I mean, she needed those breathers in between, you know. And then our second son, after college, and then he had taken a year. He was a history and was also interested in theology, and had gone to a school in Louisville that, I mean, he wasn't too happy with. I mean, the challenge wasn't there that he thought would be there. And then took a breather for a year. And this was a rough year for them because they were married and there really wasn't too much income. And then went on to law school, and he's an attorney now. So it did work out fine. Our oldest one was quite normal, went through college. But they were the kind that needed breathers in between, and you were there to support them if they. I think that's the hardest part of being a parent, you know, when you know if they're going a certain way, they're going to have trouble, but you have to be there to pick them up, you know, and go on from there.
Yeah. So giving them more and more rope to hang themselves if they want to, and letting them fail if they need to make decisions.
That's part of learning what life is all about. But being there, you know, that to pick them up when they need to be picked up. And they knew that. I mean, that they had our support. Otherwise, I mean, I don't think ours is an unusual family.
Well, I know in my own family, I was the oldest of five, and I was the only one that went off to college, went through and finished in the discipline in which I began, and just went straight through.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I take that back. My sister went into nursing and went straight through, but the other three sons all changed majors at least once, all ended up doing things differently than they thought they would, but as you say, two of them are veterinarians, you know, many years of school after they finally decided what they're going to do, and one went through school, part of graduate school, and decided to go back to be a farmer, and that's where my oldest is now, is back learning to farm from him, so you never know. It's
the right angles there. It's really fun to watch,
yeah.
You know, like our daughter thought that she'd go into music and humanities, you know, and then to fill a distribution course, she had taken geology, just loved it, and there she went.
I think it's, yeah. I think it's an important thing to see that behind both of your comments is a kind of an idea that there's an increasing flexibility about what is normal and what people should do. And when I started college, almost everybody wanted to finish in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I finished college after 4 years, about half my class had dropped out for a year just because it was too much, or they wanted to take a breather, as you said. Or,
mm-hmm.
You know, what sometimes we expect doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Your experience doesn't tell you that. I mean, as far as Christian experience affirms that too, I think that God works in ways that is very unexpected in our lives. Something that intrigues me about just my limited exposure to families is how they deal with the unexpected. What happens if my son doesn't graduate from high school? Like everybody else's sons do. I mean, is that it? Is that the end of the line? What happens then? What if my son or daughter doesn't graduate from college? No. That's okay. You know, that's not going to be the end of things. I work with adults all the time in a GED preparation class where the age of 21 or 25 or 30 or 35 have achieved enough success in their life outside of school to come back and try to get that high school diploma. That takes an immense amount of courage, for one, but it also takes enough flexibility on their part to say that somebody else's expectations of what they thought was normal doesn't need to apply for my life anymore. If there's one thing that I've begun to appreciate in good families, it's their flexibility about how not to lay expectations on each other as far as, you know, what ought to happen at the age of 21, or what ought to happen at the age of 18 or 25. You know, by 25 you should be well into your career and probably married. Well, how many 25-year-olds do you know that fit that mold? I know pretty many 25-year-olds that don't, so.
We talk about the unexpected happening. Our second son, had rheumatic fever when he was a kid. He was hyperactive. He had to be in bed for a year, which they never would do to a child now for rheumatic fever. He was in convalescent home for 9 months, and he was a very poor student. We didn't think he'd ever make it through high school, but he did. Maybe they just passed him, I don't know. Mm. But he tried college, which we knew he couldn't possibly make because of his background. And when he couldn't make that, he enlisted in the Air Force, and he's done nothing but climb up. And right now, he'd spent 20 years in the Air Force and retired and took a job with McDonnell Douglas, and he's over in Saudi Arabia now.
Mm.
But he will be coming home, and we're very anxious about what he will be doing with his life now. Of course, he's married, has two children.
At the age of?
He's 40, you know, 41.
Mm. That will be a difficult transition, won't it?
Yeah.
First time maybe he'll be outside of an institution that can guarantee him this total sense of security.
Yes,
as far as
he's never been had anything but a structured life.
Uh-huh. Well, that can take on the quality of an extended family for some folks too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some folks enter monastic orders. That's the very same reason it strikes me. No? Or they enter into a situation where they're sheltered. In some way, like the military can be that for some people, I think. I can't get a job, so I may as well get into the
mm-hmm.
military.
Oh,
that can be positive. That can be a real good place to build and to grow.
Well, his life has been a surprise to us all the way, because doctors said, oh, he'll never be accepted in military. What am I through?
Amazing, yeah.
But he's so different from the rest of our children in just about all ways, you know. He's just are very different.
Yeah. How have you dealt with that difference? I mean, in later adult years, like?
We haven't dealt with it, you know, it's
yeah.
his life. You know.
How have the siblings dealt with his being?
There's been, that's been the problem. Our grandson is here with me, and he's a pretty normal kid, but and Dick didn't have a divorce. He was married 12 years. From that marriage, there were two children. But the oldest girl is really emotionally disturbed girl, I would say.
Mm.
She's been in a boarding school in Switzerland, which has helped her, because she was on her own. She had to make it, you know. But they wanted to finish school there, but for some reason they decided to come home. So. He could have stayed over in Saudi if he wanted to.
She's a pretty, you said the son is a pretty normal child. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. The son is Richard, who's here.
Uh-huh.
I guess he's normal, isn't
yeah.
he?
Whatever normal means.
Yeah. hasn't had any traumatic problems.
He keeps himself busy.
That's normal.
But he's
yeah.
13, but his sister is 17. She'll be a senior this year, so I don't know how she'll do.
Hmm. I just, you know, tripped on that word, because I think we do stuff to each other when we lay normality on each other.
Yeah.
And we kind of say, you know, if you are abnormal, if you don't fit into what we think your family ought to be or your development ought to be at this point, something's wrong with you, and therefore we've got to react differently to you. We can't treat you like we would treat anybody else. There's something very interesting that's happened the last 20 years that was started by a Catholic priest by the name of Jean Vanier. Anybody ever heard that name? Jean Vanier started a movement called L'Arche International. L'Arche International is a monastic order, in a sense. It was begun by Catholic brothers. Jean Vanier began this journey when he decided, after 20 years of postgraduate work and teaching in one of the most prestigious Catholic universities in the world, in Paris, decided that he didn't want to do any more of this. He simply wanted to live with people in community.
he had some other brothers to go along with him. He started a house, but they had to have a raison d'etre. They had to have a reason to be. So what did they notice? They noticed a lot of mentally retarded adults with no place to live and inhumane treatment. So they began to live with these people, invite them into their home, create a place for them. These abnormal people. Strange, strange aberrations of people. People that were developmentally were perhaps even second or third grade intelligence, maybe emotional development, even more retarded than that. Because people had treated them abnormally for so many years. Well, Jean Vanier has proceeded to engage this community as a normal community, of which he is as much part as anybody else, of which he is as wounded as they are, and treat them in the sense that a Christian community exists, as everybody is equal. Okay? He's written a number of books about it. My favorite is Be Not Afraid, in which he talks about community. And all along he's talking about how we treat each other as abnormal or normal. And what comes through is the deepest levels of love and acceptance and commitment to community, regardless of how we think each other ought to be. And I think that that's something that we can keep in mind when we think about what's normal and what's not normal. You know, what's a developmental stage that you should be at this point? Because what he's observed is the degree of maturation that's taken place is incredible in mentally retarded people when they're in a loving, unconditionally accepting atmosphere. Maybe that's the key to a lot of things, that maybe that can tell us some things about what families can be if they are sanctuaries where acceptance is not based upon what is thought to be normal or what the Jones are doing or what other things are happening. End of sermon. But I think that we do lay a trip on each other when we think about normality.
On the other hand, when kids do things like run away from home or get in trouble with the law, you can't consider that normal. I mean, that's...
Okay.
And we haven't had any experience quite like that, but we have had things that we certainly won't put up with as normal for our household.
Like what?
Like pot smoking or things like that.
Okay.
Or underage kids drinking at our house, whereas other houses in the community, that's tolerated. It's not normal in my house. Anyway. That's,
I'm glad our kids are older. I think,
it's tough.
You know, when our children grew up, that there wasn't quite the temptations or the peer pressure to do things like, although I can remember them, doing things we didn't approve of, but they knew right from wrong.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they'll do things and without too much criticism from us, a little later, by they wouldn't do the same thing. I don't know what the answer is today. And like I say, I'm just thankful that ours are older. I'm anxious to
see. It's a selfish feeling, but I know I can relate to what you're saying.
You wonder how parents sometimes can survive. Because it's so hurt.
We thought the late 60s were bad.
Yeah.
How are your kids surviving at parenting?
What?
Okay. Did your kids talk about how they parent or what they experience?
Our kids, with their children?
With their children, yeah.
Yeah, and now we have two, and our two oldest teenagers are 17. And so far, well, of course, one of them is this girl that we're concerned about.
Yeah.
And so far, she hasn't been in trouble, but she hasn't had enough freedom where she could be in trouble. But now the rest, we'll just have to wait and see. Randy seems to be doing all right, and I don't know about Lori. She's a little wilder.
But I guess my question, but what's behind my question is the thought how could you support your children or affirm your children in their own parenting work?
Mm-hmm. In their own work?
Their own parenting, in their own fostering of growth in their kids.
Yeah. Well,
how could that happen?
Just keep, let them do it themselves, you know, not interfere. I think
keep away mm-hmm. at all costs. Okay, that's one way to do it.
I just think, you know, they know themselves what's right and wrong if they don't teach their children. And sometimes it doesn't do any good, because I know Mal is certainly, you couldn't find two better parents than Mal and Jane. And mm-hmm. Still things don't go the way you want them to.
So no matter what you're feeling or thinking about what they're doing, to leave your judgments.
And keep up.
Yeah. Okay. How do you work with that?
Well, we keep up, but we only have one little grandchild.
Ah, okay.
She's only two. But you can see, I think Gary and Jane are doing a bang-up job with Little Emily. She's a little foster baby that we hope can be adopted very, very soon. That they, Jane had had a miscarriage, and then finally it developed that she had to have a complete hysterectomy. And then while waiting for adoption, they said that they also put their name on a foster care list. Okay, their first one was a 17-year-old, and Gary says, wow, from not being a parent to being a parent of a 17-year-old was quite an experience. And the next one, they had called Jane. There was a little tiny baby who had been not fed or fed or diapered, and she had been in the hospital for 11 days. And would they take her? And they explained it to Jane. Well, Gary wasn't home at the time, so they said that they would have to have a little family confab on it. Well, bright and early the next morning, before they had even called to say what decision they had reached, they brought her to the doorstep. And even after 11 days in the hospital, you know, she still had the distended tummy and little arms, you know. She was under 2 months, just a little bit under two months. And with all the tender love and care that they gave her, she has just bloomed and blossomed. That, you know, the doctor had told them to watch out for retardation because of the severe deprivation that she had experienced. But she is just developing wonderfully. But the love has done a lot, though, too. At least I attribute it. They're just really great with her. And here's another thing. When you were at and talking about in our spiritual lives and praying, you know, I prayed so long that, dear God, let me be a grandma someday, you know. Never dreaming that he'd answered in that way. He's our only married son, and so.
Unexpected. Right?
Unexpected. I thought of that this morning when June was talking, you know, it was unexpected.
Yeah.
Right, so.
Well, let's get back to how do you raise kids in the 80s that are 18 or older? How do you do it?
My view is that when they're 18 or older, you're done raising them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that later on, it's like all things. Later on, you discover how wise your parents were, but you're not going to listen to them at that point. You have to be make your own decisions. And so I think my view is that it's a matter of getting them on their own just as quickly as is reasonably possible. I choose to say that I will support a college education for them if they choose that, but if they choose not to do that, this has been a running argument with our second, because he says, you're willing to pay several thousand dollars a year to send me to college, why don't you just give me that? And I say, that's not your decision, that's mine, and you gotta do it. So, but my view is his development in terms of what he thinks is right and wrong, assuming responsibility for his own acts, I'm done with that.
Someday you'll be real proud of both of them, yeah.
Well, I hope so. It's up to them now. I'm done.
Are you two related?
No.
You see your kids grow up. like our three sons, our daughter did better. She stayed in college 3 years and then got married, but she's real happy, so that's all right. But the three sons, you know, they all tried college, and none of them stuck with it. Not because they weren't able to, as far as intelligence was concerned, but they just weren't probably ready for it. And probably there wasn't, they didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives. And our oldest son came back from, when he didn't make it in college, he enlisted in the Navy. And he lasted there until he got through with his basic training. He's always had skin allergy, and he got bad infection. They sent him home. And then he was in the fire department, and worked the post office, and just, you know, from one thing to another. And he has a good job now. I don't know that his job makes him happy, but he has a nice family, active in church and everything. But you see them do that, you know, and our third son is a police sergeant, and he he wanted to go out to Washington, D.C. He thought he wanted to be an FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to college there for 2 years and worked in the FBI and decided that he didn't want to be an agent. So then he came home, got a job in the local police department, and he likes it, I guess. He seems to, but you see them go from one thing to another, you know, it takes them a while to get to where they want to go. I don't think any of them work up to their potential, but
mm-hmm.
that's not for me to decide if they're happy doing what they're doing. Or
yeah, there's some phases of adult life that they talk about in here that are really interesting. Talk about an early adult transition of moving out into the pre-adult world, and they talk about experimenting and choosing adult roles. And you're talking about later kinds of changes, but that's something of what I think a person 18 to 22 years old is about doing. Really wrestling with what kind of adult do I want to be, and where do I fit into this? What are my gifts, and how are they going to be accepted or expressed? Then the entering of the adult world, which they talk about here being 22 to 28 or so, is a place where one explores options, obviously within the limits of what they're given as far as skill or training or whatever, and also develops a stable life structure. That doesn't happen until you're about 22 or 23, according to this. Maybe it happens sooner for other people, what happens in the meantime? You know, if you're outside of your family, you don't live in an institutional setting like a school or a Holden Village or whatever, it may be more difficult for you to establish your own life structure and your own support systems. And they talk about a big change that happens about 30, age 30 transition, where one makes efforts to change or improve or correct your life structure. And also that there's a peaking of marital problems and occupational shifts. That one's absorption in the change can also pull them away from the intimacy of their marriage. And then they talk about a settling down period from 33 to 40 where one establishes a niche and starts making it. And the identifying of steps on the ladder to success makes one strive to achieve authority and independence in a given professional role. And then they talk about 40 to 50 as a point of re-stabilization. After you've kind of created your credentials from 33 to 40, they talk about how you move deeper into your involvement in whatever kind of outreach you've gotten part of. At 50, something else again happens, I think. And they're talking more and more about midlife crises for men and women. That need to reevaluate their roles and whether or not they have made it or made anything, and what they would like to do with the remaining years, how they would like to change that. Let's talk a little bit as adults about what that has looked like or might look like for you, that reevaluation stage.
You know, I'm interested, June, when did you enter the seminary?
I'll have been ordained 10 years now in September. So, you know, they didn't ordain women until 70.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I had 3 children, and in fact, Jerome was on the faculty of the seminary where I went. So I had a lot of hats to wear. I was a faculty wife, as well as a student, as well as a mother. So it was...
Was there something, a happening in your life that led you to the seminary, or was it just an interest all along?
Well, it was just kind of, I guess, propinquity. I was teaching at Wittenberg University, and as I said, Jerome was up the hill at the seminary, and this kind of gets us off into another subject, but I just kind of drifted into it. I made some statement that I thought that a lot of the seminarians' wives were college graduates, but were taking jobs just to get them through, you know, and that the men were maturing and developing and discovering new levels, and their wives were working as waitresses or, you know, teachers or whatever, you know, just to get food on the table. But I thought they ought to open, they had core groups. And I said that was my sense, that they ought to open the core groups so that the wives could be part of that developmental stage. And also that they ought to offer at least 1 or 2 courses in the evening that wives could audit, not for credit, but without tuition, just to be in on the growth process. Well, I was up at the seminary one day and I bumped into a fellow that was kind of hostile. He was one of the students, and he said, "Well, I don't see you going to any of the core groups." I said, "Well, okay, all right, you're right." So I went. And I guess I'd gone a couple months. I was sitting in on this, and one day this group said, "When are you going to come to the seminary?" I said, "Well, that's ridiculous. What do you mean, when am I going to come to seminary? Are you out of your mind?" "Well, you'd be a good pastor. You ought to come to seminary." And I said, "Oh, that's so dumb. I don't know where you came up with that. That's just ridiculous." And the next week I came to the core group and they said, "Well, have you thought about it?" And I said, "Thought about what?" "About coming to seminary." And I said, "Oh, are you still on that?" "Of course not. I got 3 kids. You know, I'm too old for that. That's way past my life. I don't have that option."
You were satisfied with where you were, too, right?
No,
no?
I wasn't.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, you know,
I'm never satisfied.
A lot of these crises happen because one grows and the other, you know, you better take both of you along, you know?
But I mean, anyway, that's just sort of how, and so then I said, you people, there was a group about like this, and I said, "You people are serious, aren't you? I mean, you're really looking at me with that." I said, "Yeah, we're serious." So Luther Steyerwald was the dean, and I went into him and I said, "Luther, I don't know, that bunch that, you know, that core group I got into," I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, they're just, I don't know where they're coming from. The last 3 weeks they've been riding my case that I ought to come to seminary." And he said, "Oh, I think you should do." So I went home to Jerome and I said, "Boy, that core group and Luther Steyerwald are just off the wall." He said, "Well, what's that?" I said, "Well, they've been pushing me that I ought to come up to seminary and take classes." He said, "Well, why don't you?"
Great. Support there.
I mean, it was like that. Mm-hmm. It was not any big. And so I did, and the next thing I knew, I was a candidate for the MDiv degree, and then I was getting assigned into an internship, and I mean, you know, it was just one thing led to another, and then I got ordained, and I had a parish, and I don't know, it was kind of, the whole thing was just upon me. And speaking of children, we have three, and I remember I came home at the supper table, and I said, well, kids, mother has news now. Oh, I said, yes, I said, I'm going to the seminary.
Oh, I can imagine.
And Kirstie, she's the middle kid. Yeah, looked at her plate. So, well, what's the matter, Kirstie? Don't you think that's a good idea? And she said, well, now think about it. How would you like to be the first kid in the block whose old lady turned into a minister?
How old were your children?
Well, let's see. She must have been, I'm trying to think about that. She's 26 now. She must have been about 13.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, about 13, I'd say.
But that she would think of that. Well, 13.
She said it's bad enough that we got to put up with Dad. No. But, and I think there was a certain, there was a situation where when I was the first woman to graduate from HAMA and to be ordained in the Ohio Synod. And we were, I'll never forget that, we were at Wittenberg College in the chapel. We had the commencement, and when I was called up to get my degree, Jerome and the three kids all went up with me.
Oh, great.
Wow.
And that whole, the whole chapel was full, and everyone rose
cheered
up and applauded.
Oh, great.
And it wasn't just a matter, you know, of my personal, oh, I mean, that was there. But I think they were applauding the fact that, you know, I was being given a Master of Divinity degree, and that some new ground was broken here. Mm-hmm. And the whole church celebrated that. Mm-hmm. However, my daughters, especially my oldest daughter, has said very often, it's very hard having a mother like you. You know, she has said, you're a tough act to follow, Mom. Mm-hmm. You're really a tough act to follow.
My parents keep saying that maybe we're laying stuff on our kids without knowing it by the same thing.
They're built in.
Because I went straight through school, then went to a master's degree, went off to work, went back, got a PhD. My wife has gone to school and got two master's degrees. And it's sort of like we just sort of assume that you can just roll, through that stuff and there's nothing to it.
Yeah.
And
I really
maybe subconsciously you do, but we try not to.
But you know, it's there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The model is there.
Yeah.
And the value is there.
Yeah.
And it's not that you're imposing it, because you've struggled yourself in achieving those goals. But I mean, like in my situation, there were two. I had no brothers, and I have only one sister. There were any question that we were going to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just a built-in expectation.
Mm-hmm.
It was automatic expectation. My father was a lawyer, and I mean, that was about the beginning of my senior year. It was, well, now, Junie, you want to go to St. Olaf, don't you? You know,
well, they had already picked, even.
Well, now that, I don't mean to. I've been trying to sit here and be quiet and listen. But now that was another one. You see, my father, all the East Folds had gone to St. Olaf, and my sister didn't. See, that left me.
Uh-oh.
So he said, Junie, if you go to St. Olaf 2 years, you can go anywhere you want to go.
Oh, my.
Thinking, you know, of course, that I'd get there and I'd get in the swing of it. Boy, I tell you, right to the exact last day of the second semester of my sophomore year,
you're right.
I marched in my father's office and I said, I'm going to the University of California in Berkeley.
Oh.
And I thought that man would have a stroke. And I held him to to it too. I said, you've never made a promise that you haven't kept. And I put in my 2 years. So I went.
That's interesting. You're part of the transition generation where you went for a professional calling after you had children, but now these ages that Kent has been listing here are going to go kerflooey because the average age of first child now has gone way up because
yes.
people are going to
into the 30s.
Their profession before making the choice of children. I don't know which, in terms of parenting and raising a family, which is really going to be the best in terms of how you keep a family together. My wife's brother and sister-in-law had their first child at age when she was 38 and he was 40, and now they're expecting their second, and she's 41. And and parents are going to be much older when they're going through the stuff that my wife and I have just gone through these past 3 years, and if I were 10, 15 years older, it would be much harder to go through than it has been now.
I don't see how you can be a companion to your children at that age. It's hard enough to anybody to be a companion to your children, which I think you, any parent should
be. That's a good
be.
Point. Yeah.
And now you're 60 years old and your child is 14, 15 or whatever, and well, you're changing.
Yeah, that's right. And nobody has reflected on what the situation with the children does to your marriage. You know, I notice that's also in your chart.
I mean that
as the shifts come in the children's development, that how do you, you know, like for example, you and your wife, I mean, does this become a source of tension? And does it get to be strongly a father-son pull, you know, with her feeling in the middle of this kind of thing? Or, and does it, because that would be fairly typical, it would seem to me, that it would put stress on the basic unit, which was the, the husband-wife unit, mm-hmm. before the kids came. And I think something I was amazed at, that I didn't expect and wasn't prepared for, because I was not your typical little housewife, you know, in the quote thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I had explored a career and I was quite independent, and I I loved my kids and all this, and but I also had a kind of protected myself, I guess, shielded myself against the reality that they had to grow and go,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, with every one of those three kids, it was absolutely traumatic for me.
Mm-hmm.
We took Fiera, the oldest one, up to Gustavus, first one to go to college, and we dropped her off up there and got her located and everything, and I thought I was just real with it, you know, going
You didn't make the bed, I hope.
No, I think she had to go and buy her own sheets. But when we got down along the Mississippi River, we were going to go into La Crosse to some friends, and I started to get this extreme pain in my rib cage. I mean, to the point where I just couldn't get my breath. It just caught me, you know. And I didn't say much to Jerome. I thought, well, maybe this is indigestion. And so I said, well, I never take that kind of stuff, but it was just, well, maybe this is heartburn or something. So we got Rolaids, and we got to our friends, and I thought, well, if I kick off my shoes and have a little glass of wine, you know, and relax, I'll be... Well, it was getting to be absolutely unbearable. Every time I took a breath, it was like a knife. And finally, I excused myself, and I said, well, I guess I'm tired. I think I'll go lay down a minute. And I went upstairs, and when I laid down, oh, I couldn't take it. I just, oh, it hurt so bad. So I came back downstairs, and when I walked down, Russ, the fellow we were staying with, said, well, in June, we have the Gunderson Clinic. We have the Lutheran. I said, what do you mean? He said, you look just awful. And he said, we're going to take you in. And so I got in, and we came to the emergency ward. And I was trying to sign in, and I started to pass out. And they got a wheelchair, and I went in there, and here I was laying on this table, and all these people around me looking at me. I said, "Say, you know, I got this funny thing here, right here." I said, "If you just give me something so we could get on the road, we're on our way to Ohio." And the doctor said, "No, I'm sorry, we're going to admit you." I said, "Well, why would you do that?" He said, "Well," he said, "from all we've been able, they had taken a couple x-rays and tests and stuff. We think you got a blood clot in the lung." And I said, "Oh my goodness." So they put me in and they dripped this stuff in my veins. And by the morning, if the thing was there, it had dissolved. But I said to the doctor, I said, "May well it be, and I'm not doubting your diagnosis, that I had a blood clot. Maybe there was a blood clot there. But I think this was induced by the trauma of my child going off to college." And he said, "Well, that might have been a factor, but let me tell you this, I learned this experience." He said, "Another factor, and people don't realize it, is you get in a car in a seatbelt, you sit with your legs crossed like this, and you ride for 6 hours, you know, quilts.
Okay.
Plus, you add to that a stress circumstance, like what you're talking about, you know, where your system is under more, you're repressing more fear and grief and so on in all of this, then you're feeling comfortable to ventilate. And you put that combination together," and he said, "you know, a lot of people on long trips have blood clots, and they dissolve on their own or they pass." She said, "It happened, yours lodged in a place where the body was giving a large signal that you were in danger. And it could very well have gone right over to the heart." You know. So I really believe, and when our second child left, we went up in the wilderness on a camping trip, and the family thought I was just a bum sport, you know? But I realized in retrospect that I was grieving the loss of my second child. I mean, that was my sense, that Kirsty will not be with us in the same way again. She is going. She's gone. And I couldn't articulate that, but I just went into this sort of deep sort of feeling of emptiness. And I would have been the last person in the world that would have said to you that I would have that emptiness stuff, you know? I mean, honest to God. Because I have so much that fills, you know, I have a lot of things that challenge me and fill my life, and lots of strokes, lots of visibility, lots of opportunity, you know, to be more than, quote, the mother.
Yes.
And yet, darn, that isn't a very deep...
And then walking by the bedroom for the first day or two, you know, where the bed is, Renee especially, you know, she was around because the clothes were all over and there it was all straightened up. That empty feeling, I can relate beautifully to that.
That's worse when they get married than when they go to college.
Is it really?
That's,
well, I'm kind of looking forward to that. I'm getting kind of up for that. That's going to be neat. I don't think I'm going to have the trouble with that. Well, of course, my son. I don't think I'll like her, whatever she is.
She doesn't even come up here, but you don't like her, whatever it is.
When our son was married, the pastor wanted to talk to the two mothers. Mm. And he told us, if either one of you starts, if there's even a start of a tear, there's a trap door below you and you'll just... But it was a really happy time.
Why do you think he said that?
Well, I suppose mothers ordinarily do cry. I mean, and that's the loss. But I didn't have that feeling either. I imagine that it was like June is looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was such a happy occasion. It was really a happy wedding. I mean, you felt more like singing than crying.
Yeah, I don't think... But I guess the reason I'm sharing all that is that I think when you go through these stages, there's a lot of subliminal stuff that may manifest itself in physical symptoms or certain feelings of tension that you can't quite locate, or you don't know. Something funny's going on. And why? I don't know. What is this going on? You know? And you really can't articulate that. In all probability, you are phasing through another
loss, death,
or stage in your life.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
You know, and you can't go back. You can't go back, and I wouldn't want to go back. But you can't go back, and then there is that, and then there is, and I think there also, when you get to be 50 and 60 and 70, you're now not thinking about your mother's death. You're beginning to get more in touch with the reality that, you know, I'm 50, I'll probably live to be 75, that means two-thirds of my life is gone.
You know? And when you realize when your the last aunt on your mother's side has died and you're the top one, you know, that's kind of traumatic too.
Well, it's true. And, you know, all that stuff is part of your subconscious. And you don't always deal with it, or like your expectation for your child. You know, you probably would love to have your two boys have their doctorates, you know, and on their way, and you know, you probably fully anticipated that would be the route they'd want to take, and they didn't take it yet. I mean, but and so there is something that says, well, it's their life and we want to be supportive. Then there's something else that kind of grinds your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is a grief process that you go through. Yeah. That letting go and that saying that you really need to give that up. You know, whether you, no matter how much you wanted to have that happen or wanted that for yourself or for them, or you know, that's your way of saying that you love them so much that you wanted that for them. And there's nothing negative about that, it strikes me. The bell is rung, we've got to close, but...
Oh, I can't hear it.
What I wanted to just affirm and what I've heard everybody saying is that, you know, number one, there is no normal stage. Number two, that we really, the stages affect us in ways deeper than we consciously process. That it affects our behavior pervasively in every aspect
of
it. You know,
some things are just too profound to say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you
don't process it consciously at all.
You don't consciously.
Yeah.
It's happening to you. You're in the midst of it. It's irreversible and it's a reality. And you're responding to it in ways that you're not totally in control of. I really believe that.
I went through this a couple of years ago when a brother-in-law died of cancer. But suddenly, within a couple months, and then a change of job, and that's when Renee left, mm-hmm. and a couple other things happened along, and they were all losses. And when I had my hair started to come out in bunches, you know, and hadn't stopped to analyze, you know, and I thought, look what you've gone through, Marvel. I mean, this is the physical reaction.
It's exactly
to it.
Mm-hmm. See. Mm-hmm.
Let's close. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.